Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The thing you gotta know here is that hedge fund guys are gonna do what hedge fund guys are gonna do. High finance today and the foods you eat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 6th day of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. You know, you could go your whole life not knowing the names of a lot of the bigwigs on Wall Street and be perfectly fine. I don't recommend it, but you could. One person you might have heard of, though, is a guy by the name of Bill Ackman. He runs Pershing Square Capital Management. It's a hedge fund, and he's been busy buying up a $5.5 billion stake in Mondelez International. That's a food giant based out of suburban Chicago that makes chocolates and snacks, Oreos and Ritz crackers, those kinds of things. The educated guessing is that Ackman's going to push Mondelez to cut costs and that in due time a merger will be in the cards. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports there has been a lot of that kind of thing going on in food these days.
There's been a big shift in Americans' tastes in recent years towards fresh foods and away from processed foods. Bernstein analyst Alexia Howard says Mondelez and other big food industry giants are getting hit by those trends. But she says Mondelez has some buffers.
Mondelez only has 20% of sales in the U.S., and it's in the U.S. where we're seeing this big turnover in attitudes towards health and wellness.
So some of its iconic brands like Oreos still sell well in emerging markets. O-R-E-O. Howard says, sure, Mondelez could stand to boost its revenue even more.
But that's not really what Ackman and others are focused on. That's much more around the cost cutting and the margin potential.
Now, just over a year ago, Mondelez announced a big plan to slash costs. But the tie-up of Kraft and Heinz and the merged company's subsequent cost-cutting spree is apparently making everyone else look bloated. So says Aaron Lash, an analyst with Morningstar.
The recent merger places a new bar with regards to profit expectations.
Lash suspects if Mondelez can't cut costs aggressively enough, it could be a target for Kraft Heinz in a year or two. Bob Golden is with Technomic, a food industry research and consulting firm. He says, for now, one thing is clear. Activist investor Bill Ackman is going to have a big say in the future of Mondelez.
I'm quite certain they'll be senior meeting with management if they haven't already begun today.
And Golden suspects Ackman will have a clear agenda. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We talked a little bit yesterday about pay and benefits in the workplace. Today, a follow-up of sorts about the gender pay gap. Let's say you made it to the second interview for that job you desperately want, and the hiring manager asks a question that is considered taboo in most other situations. How much are you making right now? The federal government wants to make that question a bit more taboo in the hiring process, the theory being that not relying on past salaries to set future pay might help close the pay gap. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes it from there.
So, not basing a new salary on an old one. Good idea, bad idea?
I think it's great. It is about time.
I think it's a step in the right direction.
More from those guys in a minute. This move came from the Office of Personnel Management, which found last year that women in government made almost 13% less than men in 2012. Some agencies have been required to use current salary info when hiring new employees. OPM now says that's only one factor that may be used to set pay. But doing away with that practice completely would be a good thing, says Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research.
You try to assign pay to the job. So you say, okay, this is a job that requires X, Y, and Z, and then you look to find the best person for the job.
Using current salaries can penalize women who took time off to have kids or chose more flexible jobs, says Randy Albelda, a professor at UMass Boston. Plus,
lots of research that shows women are terrible negotiators over their salary compared to men. And where you start determines where you end up.
This would be like a fresh slate, making sure past discrimination didn't carry into the new job. It won't totally solve the gender pay gap, but Eileen Boris, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, says the government can be a model for the private sector.
Because it has set a best practices that many employers then follow, particularly those who depend on government contracts.
Boris says if the feds really want to close this gap, Congress could pass equal pay legislation. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Today is GOP debate day. As you know, we're going to walk right on by that whole smash, except to say this. If you're going to watch, watch with us, why don't you? I'll be live tweeting. Our reporters and editors will be keeping the candidates honest. 9 o'clock Eastern, marketplace.org is the place to be. Usually on the day before the monthly unemployment report, which today happens to be Wall Street, just kind of marches in place. Not so on this day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Take 4 years of drought, hot, dry, windy weather, and you're pretty much perfectly set up for a long summer and fall of big, scary wildfires out west. The Rocky Fire north of San Francisco has burned more than 100 square miles. It's still going strong up there. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the disastrous economics of this season's natural disasters.
20 years ago, the U.S. Forest Service spent about 16%, that's 1/6, of its budget on fighting fires. This year, it's spending more than half.
The trends aren't getting better. We've doubled the amount we've burned over the last 30 years, from about 3.5 million acres to 7.
Robert Bonney is Undersecretary of Natural Resources and Environment at the Department of Agriculture. He says it's likely due to a number of things, climate change and drought, not least among them. But it's the size of the fires that's really eating up the budget.
1% of fires cost about 30% of our overall firefighting budget. So you get these huge mega fires. And those types of fires cause an enormous amount of challenge to fight, but they're also incredibly expensive.
California's not even into the peak of its fire season, and Governor Jerry Brown has already declared a state of emergency in many counties. Lynn Tomalchoff is spokeswoman for Cal Fire.
These fires that we're seeing are burning very dangerously. It's very extreme and explosive type of situation. And the firefighters are having to be very, very careful about the choices that they make.
The Rocky Fire is burning land so parched by years of drought that firefighters have had to change the way they're fighting it. The fire breaks that they're cutting today, for example, have to be much wider. Fighting fires in an urban setting is one thing.
But if you're in a wildland setting, you're now in a matrix of fuel with solitary or scattered housing, which is much more vulnerable.
That's Richard Minnick. He's a professor at UC Riverside focusing on fire ecology. Minnick says more than funding, he thinks it's a planning problem. More and more homes are encroaching on forests in California and other western states. And when those fires rage, people are forced to evacuate.
You know, if houses keep recycling in fires, what is the point? Especially if it's at the cost of the state.
Last year, California spent almost $500 million fighting wildfires. The rainy season, if it comes at all, won't hit until November. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
New York City, as I think we all know, has one of the world's great skylines. Iconic is not an overstatement here, but it is a dynamic thing, that skyline is, changing with each new construction. It's about to change some more with what are called pencil towers, new super skinny, super tall buildings that are going up and that are also controversial for a number of reasons, one of which is the shadows that they cast on the ground. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
This is Central Park. We have bikers, picnickers, loiterers, some turtles. And this park is smack in the middle of an ongoing ruckus, allegedly over shadows.
Buildings going up to 90 and 100 stories.
This is City Councilman Mark Levine.
Just footsteps from the southern perimeter of Central Park, casting unacceptably long and obtrusive shadows in the park.
Levine sponsored a bill to study any building that might throw shadows on any park. The buildings Levine is especially worried about, and there are at least a dozen of them in various stages of development or construction, include one that'll have the tallest rooftop in North America, 84 stories, 1,428 feet.
Central Park is a backyard for countless New Yorkers, and I think we need to look at sunlight as a public good.
But just how much sun are these buildings going to actually block? They are very skinny. Insanely skinny. The one I'm standing under now, 432 Park Ave, is just 93 feet on each side, but will rise to nearly 1,400 feet.
These are tall, slender buildings. The shadows are there for a few minutes at any one position because they are that.
Gary Barnett founded Extel Development. They've put up one tower and are in the process of constructing a second.
Parks are a good thing. Parks need a certain amount of sunlight. Having said that, none of the buildings that are being built in any way impinge on the flora, the fauna, the use, the enjoyment of the park. And that, to me, is, you know, basically irrefutable.
People have fought over sunlight for a very long time. Gerald Kaden is professor of urban planning and design at the Harvard Graduate School of Design.
The idea of protecting access to sunlight is an ancient one. You can track it back to the English common law, which contained and still does contain a centuries-old doctrine known as ancient lights.
The basic idea was you're not allowed to block your neighbor's light. That right does not exist in most places in the U.S. There are zoning rules in New York about how much open sky can be blocked, and the super slender towers don't break any of them. But there are no rules or guidelines, even, about shadows in particular.
And I think as a consequence of that lack of clarity, rhetoric dominates the day.
Jesse Keenan is with the Center for Urban Real Estate at Columbia. The fight over the super slender towers is heated because the tenants of those buildings are largely billionaires, some of them from outside the U.S. And that sparked resentment among New Yorkers over and above the issue of sunlight.
Obviously, when you're talking about super tall luxury towers inhabited by billionaires, classism does paint the picture in a slightly different way.
But he says sunlight and shadow are measurable things.
I think we need benchmarks and metrics that allow us to have an informed debate.
Enter the shadow consultant.
What this graphic means is the darker, the more overlaps of the pink that you have, it means the longer duration of shadow.
Alihan Polat is with the Environmental Simulation Center. They apply digital technology to land use disputes. Polat's pointing to several computer screens of 3D models of Manhattan and maps of moving shadows.
Shadow is not something static, it's dynamic, and depending on the building configuration and massing, it can move fast, it can move slow.
They follow the shadows over the seasons, they map out sensitive areas like playgrounds. On one screen, there's a rainbow-colored heat map showing how much actual thermal energy different parts of a park are absorbing. Michael Quartler started the Environmental Simulation Center.
We could tell you that over a period of time, this is the amount of energy that will strike the bench. And is that enough energy to keep somebody comfortable during the colder months to sit outside?
Despite all the data, Quartler says it's not easy being a shadow consultant.
It's been hard.
He remembers one time a neighborhood group concerned about shadows in a park challenged him when he said the data showed, in that instance, a taller, skinnier building would cast less shadow than a shorter, squat one. They still opposed the taller building.
I said, even if it meant conserving sunlight on a small park, where that really matters, these people left the table.
Quartler hasn't done an assessment of Central Park yet. But even if he does, it probably won't settle the debate over light and shadow. There's just too much of a gray area. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up,
home cooking is such an important part of our society and our culture.
Home cooking that comes prepackaged and home delivered. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 120 points today, 2/3%, closed at 17,419. The NASDAQ off 83 points. That is 1.6%, finished at 5,056. The S&P 500 down 16 points, 3/4%, ended things at 2,083. Another big sell-off today for big media companies. Viacom, which owns MTV and Comedy Central, slumped 14% after reporting weak earnings and ad sales. Also, Jon Stewart, hello. 20th Century Fox off more than 6%. Time Warner down 0.8%. Keurig Green Mountain dripped down almost 33.0%. The company lowered its annual sales forecast. It's a coffee company, obviously. The buzz was increased competition in the single-serve coffee market. Starbucks down 3%. Today, you're listening to Market.
Behind every successful business is a story.
And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Plus.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to report consumer credit data for June. On August 7, 1789, President Washington established the War Department. It is now the Department of Defense. And David Duchovny turns 55. We'll see what's in store for Fox Mulder when he returns in 2016. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The new carbon rules that the White House announced the other day, limits to carbon emissions, I should more properly say, let states figure out how they want to adjust their energy use to get to the EPA's ultimate reduction goal. Texas, for instance, has already installed a whole lot of wind power. But Texas also relies on coal for more than a third of its electricity. And a big chunk of that coal, interestingly enough, is mined right there in Texas. Ingrid Lobet reports.
When you think about Texas, you think oil. But Tom Edgar, director of the University of Texas Energy Institute, says even people from here don't realize the state is a major coal producer.
Most people in Austin really have no clue that there is a strip mine located only 30 miles away from the city.
In fact, right by the side of the road is one of the classic machines of strip mining, a dragline with its swinging claw. About a dozen coal mines lie in a necklace across the state, from Louisiana to the border with Mexico. That line is no accident. It traces the ancient shoreline of Texas.
Many years ago, vegetation, trees, and woody matter basically was deposited there. Given enough time and given pressure and heat, you actually form this coal-like substance.
That coal-like substance's real name is lignite.
Basically, it's brown dirt.
Fred Beach is assistant director at the University of Texas Energy Institute.
Oily mud, that's another one we commonly refer to it.
Lignite does burn, Beach says, but...
For every ton of lignite coal you burn, you get less electricity from, and you also get more ash generated. You get more particulate matter in the exhaust flume and gases. So lignite coal has a lot of stuff going against it.
J.P. Nicotte, a scientist at UT's Bureau of Economic Geology, points out this young coal is also really wet, as if it hasn't fully emerged from the primordial swamp. Wet coal, like wet wood with its hiss and pop, is less than ideal for burning.
So a lot of the energy that could be used to produce electricity, you know, is actually used to evaporate the water.
In Europe, lignite is called brown coal. It's still a mainstay of Germany's energy mix. In Texas, they figured out how to make it pencil out in the 1980s.
So the only way you could make a go, a financial go, of this very minimalistic fossil fuel, kind of the last thing you'd want to burn unless all the things just lined up right. You actually build the power plant where the mine is, so the transportation cost is very low.
So that string of coal mines across the state, there's also a line of power plants right next to them burning lignite. That local coal, plus a lot more coal brought in by train, delivers reliably cheap electricity. Mike Nassy, an attorney who represents the Gulf Coast Lignite Coalition, says Texas industries like oil refining and chemical makers can't afford to lose that cheap power, which is one reason Texas has fought so hard against carbon limits.
It's not just coal producers and power producers that show up to ask for
policies to be reasonable. It's Dow Chemical, it's Occidental Petroleum, it's Valero. And the reason is because their single highest line item cost is the price of electricity.
But the EPA carbon rules are aimed at plants like these. Between a third and half of them are likely to shut down. Still, Texas's little-known second-rate coal is not all going to stay in the ground.
Lignite is going to continue to power that fleet.
I'm Ingrid Lobet for Marketplace.
Ingrid is a reporter for Burn. That's from Sound Vision Productions with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. I do a fair amount of the cooking at my house. The other night, though, it became something of a family affair.
Let's just read the menu for this evening. We are having crispy catfish with Sicilian eggplant caponata. We're having steak roasted potatoes with sautéed long beans and tomato. And we're having Mexican-style chicken tortas with tomato, avocado, and cucumber salad.
No, we don't always cook three different recipes, but I was doing a little research. One kid on potato duty.
Medium-sized chicken.
All right, come on in, Ben.
The other on eggplant.
What is this?
That's an eggplant.
This is eggplant?
Yeah. Are your hands clean?
Yes.
We're testing out a subscription service called Blue Apron. The ingredients all came in a box, shipped to the office, pre-portioned with illustrated step-by-step instructions. It's a little bit like cooking by numbers.
They give us pans?
No, they're
that's awesome.
They should totally give us pans. That would be even better.
Okay. Dad, garlic.
The price tag is about $10 per person per meal, and Blue Apron is shipping about a million of those meals a month nationwide. Matt Salzberg is the CEO and co-founder of the company. Matt, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I will say, as you just heard, we had Blue Apron for dinner at my house the other night. It went pretty well. Is what you're trying to do sort of creating that little family experience there where people are cooking without having to work too hard?
Yeah, you know, home cooking is such an important part of our society and our culture. And that's actually one of the big reasons why our business has been so successful. It's because of that emotional connection that people have to spending time at the family table.
How do you translate that, though, to the pitch to venture capitalists and investors? Because you guys have had a lot of success raising money of late. But the first time you tried it, we're gonna send people food and they're going to cook. How did that go?
It was tough. You know, the first bunch of pitches that we did, you know, venture capitalists sort of say, hey, you know, I remember Webvan.
Right,
Internet bubble.
Yeah, that was the food delivery thing that wasn't portioned out, right? It was just like grocery shopping online.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the mistakes of the internet bubble was to build businesses that tried to be all things to all people. Hmm. And we've built our business to be the exact opposite of that. And we've actually been reasonably limited in our selection on purpose as we've started the company. You know, we started off just delivering to Manhattan, and now we're fully nationwide. And we're still very focused today on dinner.
Right.
But it allows us to be very focused and focus our sourcing attention on a limited number of really high-quality things and really delighting customers.
So I fed my family the other night, six people, three different meals, as I think you might have heard on some of that tape, plus or minus $60 worth of dining, right, at $10 a pop. I can feed my family for way less than $60. So make the value proposition for me then, would you?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, of course it matters what you're feeding them. So, you know,
well, I can feed them a reasonably well-balanced and healthy meal for a lot less than $60.
Of course you can. But, you know, what we focus on are these really high-end ingredients. So, for instance, we actually have shopped for our recipes at grocery stores. And when we do that, it costs 60% more money on average to recreate our recipes by going to a grocery store. And on top of that, you know, about 30% of the ingredients that we deliver wouldn't even be available at a given grocery store. So we do all that legwork for our customers. We're delivering it to their homes on top of that. And they have no waste at the end of the day. Unlike if you went to a grocery store, you know, the average American throws out about a third of what they buy because they can't get it in the right amounts.
You're absolutely right. There's no food waste, but there is some waste that comes along with these meals, right? The ice packs, the boxes, the freezer bags. I mean, it's, you know, there is an impact here.
Certainly there's packaging, just like there's packaging, you know, if you got your food anywhere. To be honest, if you actually did the analysis and compared, you know, how much packaging
is in our ingredients per unit of food versus a grocery store, it's actually very comparable.
One of the things that made this work in my house the other night was the novelty of it. It's like, oh, look, dinner came in a box, and all we have to do is chop and slice and dice and heat some things on the stove.
Yeah.
How worried are you about that going away and then people going, oh, yeah, you know, it was fun for a while, but now, meh.
Yeah, I mean, look, we look at the data all the time of our customer retention, and our customer retention is through the roof. And the longer people are with us, the more likely they are to stay with us. You know, part of our business is being a content business. It's a culinary content business. And so our culinary team's job is to constantly come up with new content every week. And every week we come up with 10 completely original new recipes. And so the quote unquote novelty doesn't wear off because, you know, we constantly have new content. So there's always a reason to come back.
What was the last Blue Apron meal you made and ate?
Well, literally last night, my wife and I cooked a seared bavette steak with Chinese long beans.
With the long beans? We had that one in my house. We had that one.
Yeah,
We undercooked the steak a little bit, I got to tell you. But then again, my 11-year-old was in charge of the steak. So.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's an important part of my relationship with my wife. We cook together every week. It's team building. It's fun. And it's healthy.
I'm gonna hope that your wife doesn't hear this where you said it's team building with her. Matt Salzberg is the co-founder and CEO of Blue Apron. Matt, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to see what the raw materials for all that dinner we cooked looks like, we took a video. It's on our Facebook page, Marketplace APN. This final note on the way out today, we have been talking, as you know, on and off for the past year or so about the fall in oil prices. Fine, old news, I get that. Bloomberg, though, went out and did a little bit of math and came up with a really big number. $1.3 trillion has been wiped off the value of energy companies as their share prices have fallen along with the crude. It is, I know, a number so big it kind of doesn't mean anything. Until you think about this, all the pension funds and retirement accounts that have those company shares in their portfolios, not so good. Crude today, by the by, $44.50 a barrel at the close in New York. Also, don't forget debate tonight. If you're watching, watch with us, me and the Marketplace crew. Context, reaction, tweets, find all of it, marketplace.org. All right, got to go. Did I mention the debate? Yeah? Okay, good. The Dow off 120 points today, about two-thirds of 1%. The NASDAQ down 83 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 off 16 points, 0.75%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.